You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 408. In the entertainment industry, every house is made of ice, and it's melting. So you better be building a new house. Jim Gaffigan.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Now, today on the show, guys, we have writer, producer, director, actor, and filmtrepreneur, Stephen Luke. Now, in this conversation, Stephen and I discuss how he attaches bankable movie stars like Dolph Lundgren, Mickey Rourke, Chuck Liddell, James Cromwell, Sam Worthington, Tom Berenger, Ron Perlman, and Billy Zane to his independent films. We also discuss his misadventures in film distribution, how he pre-sells his films, and does he ever actually make any money with these film distributors? Now, what I also find fascinating about Stephen is that he has a brilliant filmtrepreneurial mind. He has definitely found his niche with his filmmaking, and that is war films. Understanding his niche market, he uses the films he produces to advertise his company, Man the Line, which is the internet's number one source for vintage war props, costumes, things like that. And it's pretty remarkable how he's been able to build out a business based in South Dakota by focusing on the war niche, and specifically like World War I, World War II, kind of films. Stephen was fascinating to talk to and an inspiration to say the least. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Stephen Luke. I'd like to welcome to the show Stephen Luke, man. How are you, brother?
I'm doing excellent, staying COVID-19 free up here in South Dakota. So,
well, it's West. Yeah, you don't have too many. You're not like LA. You don't have, or New York. I mean,
we literally have like the population of like one high-rise building in New York, so we're pretty safe out here for the most part.
Are you staying quarantined? Or are you kind of?
I mean, I guess this is going to be recorded, so yes, I'm very quarantined, safe, secure in a bunker in old missile silo from the '60s.
Yes.
No, we're kind of, yes, we kind of have doing the social distancing, but trying to life is a little bit kind of like normal here. So
got it. It's fair enough. Yeah. You're a little bit more spread out than the big cities.
Yeah. And everything takes 2 months to get to us. So I'm sure in August,
that's when you're going to have some stuff going on. Well, thank you for being on the show, man. Before we get started, how did you get into the film business?
Okay. That's a fun story. So I think like with everyone else, you start off when, you're young, and you kind of just the magic of cinema hits you and you get really excited to, see films and you want to tell stories. And I think that's kind of how I wanted to get involved and wanting to tell stories and, just kind of progressively working up to that point throughout my life and career and how to just kind of, tell stories and make movies and getting bigger and better.
Very cool. So you were bitten by that bug, basically.
Oh yeah.
And you can't get rid of it.
No, it's, you know, it's like that artist lifestyle, right? So it's like, mm-hmm. if I wasn't doing this or, I mean, whatever I'm doing, I'm sure I'd be, you know, doing something artistic. So got to express
myself. No, but you also got into the acting side of the business as well.
Yes. Yeah. So I always, you know, I do act. What's fun about the film business is it really is a business, and there's lots of pieces that come to that. So the acting stuff that I do, I consider that usually like my art. Mm-hmm. Like it's more of an art form to me if I come in and act. It kind of gives me a chance to dive into a character and develop them and be someone else. And it's fun for me to do that. Some of the other parts of the film making experience are more business related or more kind of world building or, you know, writing or something like that. But the acting is an art to me, and it's always kind of fun to get to jump in someone else's shoes.
But did you start off as an actor and then moved into producing, or did you start off as producing and moved into acting?
Acting – you know, in high school, you know, you do plays and stuff.
Yeah,
so
sure.
The acting was kind of always kind of that, what you want to do. I kind of realized really right off the bat, right as I kind of graduated high school, that I wanted that I could act and produce. Those are my two things that I enjoyed doing the most. So I kind of found myself when I'd produce things, trying to find, you know, pieces, you know, like a part that I could play to kind of have some fun with it as well. Because producing, for those that know, is a little stressful at
times. a bit. And you've got to wear like 1,000 different hats. And
you got to know the industry really well. So, and it's like when you get to act, you know, you kind of can just one character. And then no one bugs you either. You know, like They don't want to disturb him when he's in character. Like, yes, so leave me alone. Until that's over, then you can deal with all the craziness.
It's fun because I've always worn 1,000 hats in any of my productions. It's just the nature of what I do. I'm a jack of all trades. So when I get to just do one thing, it seems so light.
Like, well, it definitely does. Well, you sit there and you're like twiddling. You know, it's like,
okay. Yeah, it's like
I should be doing something. I should be helping someone. So.
Yeah, from my really micro budget films where I'm doing a lot to where I'm working on a series or something like that where I have a full blown crew, and I'm like, I don't have to worry about lighting. I could just tell someone to go light. It's just kind of, what am I going to do? What am I doing here? I'm waiting 30 minutes for the lighting setup to set up. I mean, like, the actors are ready. Like, I don't know. It's crazy.
Yeah, I guess I'll sit down.
I guess I'll relax. I guess. I don't know.
I'll have a Coke.
So then how did you get into, you know, producing full features? Because I saw you did a lot of shorts prior to get your feet wet. How did you get into doing full-blown features?
Yeah, so I always think it was important to do some short films, test your craft, do some, you know, make some mistakes, learn a lot. To me, and shorts were kind of a great way to do film school. I didn't go to film school. I took more of the business side of things and got a, you know, kind of when I was in college, got a business degree because that was what I felt was going to be more helpful to me just in terms of what I kind of wanted to pursue. But yeah, short films, great way to kind of hone your craft. And then you want to make that leap to a feature film if, you know, your goal, and there's lots of goals, obviously, but if you want to try to tell bigger and better stories, if you want to try to make money, I mean, relatively speaking, that you kind of the feature film game is where you need to be. And naturally, that's kind of the next step that a filmmaker should try to pursue. It has its own, I mean, making a feature film and a short film, they almost have the exact same challenges and go through the exact same steps. You just are feature film takes is longer days. Mm-hmm. So it naturally was that next step that one takes.
So one of the reasons I wanted you on the show is because a lot of the movies that you've produced have been with, you know, name talent that actually brings money to the table. And I always wanted to have someone on the show that has produced these kind of films, worked with talent like Dolph Lundgren or Ron Perlman or Mickey Rourke or Tom Berenger, Billy Zane. These are like kind of go-to character actors who have a following and also have a value, a monetary value, in distribution and overseas. So I wanted to kind of dig into the how you do this. And I also want to take away a lot of these myths and illusions that a lot of filmmakers have, like, oh, I could never afford, you know, Dolph Lundgren or Mickey Rourke or Ron Perlman or these kind of actors, because they must be billions and billions of dollars to get. And I've been in the industry long enough to know that that's not true. But I wanted to hear straight from the horse's mouth. So how do you go about, first of all, attaching name talent like this?
Right. Okay. So I think the and I'm a big proponent of this. Always the first step with name talent is your script. Now, obviously, that kind of can play in a lot of key points with lots of things. But if you have a script that obviously is what you feel like a winner, something you enjoy, a story you want to tell, that is definitely like the number one way to get talent to say yes. They've got to like that script. And so kind of hand in hand with that, the role that you might be offering them, it has to be a role that, you know, like you see that person, you know, like, okay, like take Dolph Lundgren, like Dolph will have fun with this role, or, you know, so like when you come to those towns, and sometimes that might mean you adapt your role a little bit for the specific person that you're going after. But like they have to like, okay, if they read this, they've never done that character before, or maybe it's a character that they enjoy doing. So I think really tailoring your story and the role that you're going after before you present it to them is vital, because if it's just generic, you know, office worker, you know, they're going to pass on that.
unless the paycheck is extremely high.
Yeah. I mean, that's going to take probably double what maybe they would actually cost, because they're like, well, if they're willing to pay me that.
Like, why would you bring Dolph Lundgren is the office worker, unless it's a comedy, and then yes.
And you have the budget to do it, and that probably actually would be hilarious.
Imagine. I mean,
Dolph is a great guy, too. I mean, he's a fantastic actor and a super smart man.
No, I hear he's like genius level. He's like really, really smart. Even when he did the Expendables, they would make jokes about it in the movie. They're like, what are you, a brain, like a rocket scientist? Like, he is like, literally,
he's that smart. And so, like, when you first kind of meet him, when you talk to him, I don't want to say it throws you for a loop, but you know, most people grow up with "I will break you," and when he talks to you, you're like, "Geez, this guy's way smarter than me."
Right?
Not like that on film. And you're just—it's a fun story. Okay, so back to you got your script, you mm-hmm. got your you got your role for these guys. So probably they always talk about like the gatekeepers that come. That are in Hollywood.
Yes.
So for the talent, it really is their managers and agents. I mean, manager, agent, they guard those guys and all their clients, which is that's what they get paid to do. So probably the best way then to like, you know, to get an agent and manager, okay? You know, having a producer that maybe has worked with them in the past. Having, you know, maybe a sales rep that has worked with them in the past, you know, personal contact, emailing them straight up on IMDb sometimes even can get you to the door. I mean, I hate to say that, but like, you know, they might have an assistant, but they read. I mean, if they have an assistant, they process that stuff. So that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, you're going to get Dolph Lundgren in your film if you just email him with an offer, because they
it doesn't work that way.
Well, it doesn't work that way. But if you have a level of if you're attached to someone that maybe has worked with him, the legitimacy of that offer of the script and the role and maybe the price tag that you're offering them, they will take it to their client. They're required to take those things to their client if they feel it's actually a legitimate thing. And so by having someone, and I'm just going to use like me, for example. Like, I've worked with Dolph Lundgren, you know, for me to maybe put like a filmmaker in touch with his manager and saying like, hey, I think that, you know, that X, Y, and Z wants to, you know, is interested in having Dolph with the role. You know, I'll let him present it over to you. They will take that as a sign that I vetted that person. I wouldn't be doing that unless it was a real thing, just in terms of real. Because if I do that –
You're Donnie Brasco-ing it. He's a good fella. Yeah,
this is not like a real thing. I might not never get to work with that agent ever again. So that's why it's such a big, you know, it's a big deal to be able to be, you know, when that happens, they'll take you seriously. But I'm not saying that they don't just email them straight up. Doesn't work.
Real quick. So let me jump on that real quick. One question. And this is a big question when it comes to talent. And I've heard both sides of the story. I would love to hear your thoughts. If you have a personal relationship or a personal connection to the talent, do you bypass their management and talk to them directly or make an offer to them directly if you have a direct connection? Now, if you're good friends, it's one thing.
Yeah.
If you're buddies, it's one thing. But let's say I know somebody who knows the actor personally. And I'm like, hey, look, I'll make you an associate producer if you make the introduction to me. And then I go have coffee with Dolph. And then Dolph's like, hey, I really like your thing. And I make him the offer directly. And then I've completely bypassed. I'm just throwing out the scenario. Hold on before you say no. And you like talk to them and like, hey, look. You know, I'd like to offer it to you directly. A lot of people will do that faux pas, which in my opinion too, you shouldn't offer them directly unless it's a conversation. You know, like I always say when I'm working with talent of that level, I go, do you want me to submit a formal offer to your agent or manager? And sometimes they're like, no, what do you want? What do you got? And they'll just want to negotiate with you right there. Sure. There's that talent as well.
Yes, I would say like if you're in a situation like that, I mean, if they're open to it, that might be different. I would say, in my opinion, if you were in that situation where you're like talking to the actor and they're loving the role, you know, like just offering them a role and having them say, I love this, I want to do this is like a win. Mm-hmm. And then I would automatically go to, oh, right, great. I will get in touch with your agent and manager. Mm-hmm. Out the details, because at the end of the day, you still got to work out the details with the agent manager. Because there's not only is that their price, there's their green M&Ms that they need, there's their flights, you know what I mean? Like, there's an entourage that might have to come. So, like, you're still gonna have to work with the agent manager on the deal memo. And so, you should, if at least in that way, the agent manager feels, I don't want to say useful because they're very useful, but that's their job. So respecting them right off the bat and saying like, hey, great, Dolph loves this role. Let me go work it out with the agent manager. They will instantly – I don't want to say like you have an ally, but you won't make them mad, because agents and managers do not like to be circumnavigated. They don't like it. And I can – and you know, as much as like sometimes you wish you could just go right to it, and you can sometimes when you know the talent – you know, get them excited about the role. That's already a win for you because you know that they're going to want to do it. They mm-hmm. want to do it. And then go back to that, you know, agent manager. That way everyone stays happy. And then the actor's not having to deal with any, you know, the other than the money, the other things that entail that. Agent manager can be the good guy, bad guy, good cop, bad cop, you know. It's definitely an industry. And I had a manager tell me this. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, like always, like, it's great, you know, the talent, they want to do the role, then just come back to me and keep it in that line. Hollywood's very much like,
yeah, there's a story of a couple filmmakers I knew that they bum rushed an actor at a film festival and got him literally in the back alley. This is an Oscar nominated actor. And the actor was cool. He was like, tell me, pitch me. And he showed him like the sizzle reel. And the actor was very taken by their story. And this actor does not do an independent, like he's only studio. But for whatever godforsaken reason, he fell in love with the story and wanted to do it. And he was over at CAA. And CAA did everything to torpedo that deal. Like everything. But then,
well, you know, those guys did. I mean, but the thing that those guys got, they knew the actor wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. So CAA lost all those playing cards. Now, they might not have been happy about it, but like that is the one nice thing. If you can get around them and you just find out if they want to do it, then you got
right.
You got the.
But then afterwards, the actor just turned to their agents like, look, guys, I don't care what you say. I'm doing this. So let's make this happen. And that's But that's a risk. You're rolling the dice when you do something like that. That's extremely risky.
You can find an actor in a back alley and corner him. I mean,
literally.
I would do it, but.
Right. And they were young independent filmmakers. They weren't like, you know, seasoned professional.
Sometimes that's literally, I mean, you get lucky like that. It's kind of just, you get lucky and everything, the stars lined up and that worked out great for him. So I definitely am not opposed to having that happen. Because sometimes when you're trying to get your film made, I mean, you gotta play hardball. It's hardball, man.
Absolutely. All right. So you were continuing. All right. So now, so what's the next, the process as far as attaching these guys?
Okay, so let's story script, contact the agent manager, you know, so then you're wanting to, it's the money, you know, sometimes with a lot of this talent, it really does come down to, you know, they're going to assume after they read the script that they're going to, okay, this is a worthwhile story script. I can enjoy this character. Then it really comes down to their rate. You know, what are they willing to do it for? And it really is. I mean, let me back up because it is money. But like, who am I acting along with could matter too.
Mm-hmm. Like, who's the director?
The director. What's the budget of the film? Like, do I have to fly to Taiwan because that makes a big deal to them? Like, or can I just wake up and roll out of my bed and go 30 minutes over to Pasadena and shoot and then come back? I mean,
that's huge.
Able to do that for them. So like accommodating them along with that offer with like, hey, we're going to be, you know, 10 minutes away from your house. So all you have to do is just get out of bed and
we'll go pick you up.
We'll come pick you up. And, you know, so sometimes like literally that, if the money's good, and doing that, and they can be like, well, I don't really care who I'm in with and who the director is.
It's a day, yeah. It's a couple days, and I'm home. I'm
back home to sleep in my bed. So one day or 2 days or whatever it is.
So that's the thing that a lot of filmmakers, especially young producers, don't understand is that if you have, you know, Dolph, let's say, or Mickey in a role and you have them on the cover of the poster, it doesn't mean that you shot them for 3 or 4 weeks. You know, you could shoot them out in 2, 3, 4 days or less, depending on how big their part is. But you can shoot all their scenes out quickly and affordably, because if you tried to hire them for 3 or 4 weeks, it would be cost prohibitive.
Yeah, and they don't do that either. I mean, they wouldn't sign on to doing a 3-4 week thing unless it was
a big studio, you know, or
super big, or a studio or a big project. If you kind of live in that world of a week or less, mm-hmm. 2 weeks, and if you're able to coordinate the character around those scenes, I mean, a good rule of thumb, I think right now with distributors is, you know, they need about 12 to 15 minutes of screen time at least out of those guys, which is about the equivalent to about 15 pages. So if you can get 50, I mean, how quickly can you shoot 15 pages? Now, mm-hmm. I'll tell you this, like, you know, usually, I mean, I've knocked out an actor with 15 pages in one day.
Oh yeah, me too. Yeah. Oh,
it's doable, but I will tell you this: with the talent, like, they will not be happy about that per se. I mean, they're not going to be angry.
Yeah,
but like, it could take cue cards, and it could take, you know, like hiding their lines in, you know, spots so they can just do their thing, and it could take
earbud. Earbuds. Don't forget the earbud.
Oh, I forget about the earbuds.
I had a whole VFX job once that this was an Oscar winning actor who was later in his career, and he had earbuds because he couldn't remember his lines, and we had to digitally remove all the earbuds in all his shots because it was a period piece.
Sure. I believe it.
I mean, you know, it's insane.
Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't say you would think the actors would come prepared. They usually are prepared, but you know, if you can just get them there, I mean, they know, you know, a lot of the actor, you know, like, when they're named actors, they understand that it's going to be my name and my face on the poster that sells it. So who cares if I know my lines? I mean, that's not saying that they don't know that, but like, you know, you got to accommodate them sometimes.
So this is the big question, you know, can we discuss the cost? Now, we're not going to call anybody out directly. We're not going to go, well, Dolph is this much and you know, Mickey is this much, nothing like that. But can we talk about a range, you know, per day? Because I've worked with certain actors and I know of prices of certain actors who are name actors. But what is a range price? Because I think people still, filmmakers still think like, oh, I can't afford that guy, even if it's for 3 or 4 days. And you'd be surprised that you might.
Yeah. Well, I think you're looking at, and I don't mind saying these things, because I think they're stuff that the industry should know. And I think, you know, I mean, the more kind of money that can go to, like with projects that can go to actors, I think always the better. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it's an issue at all. So let's talk about money. So maybe let's put a range of, say, $50,000 to up to $300,000. Mm-hmm. That is your budget range. And you might get an actor of a name caliber for 1 day to 8 days or 7 days. Let's say 7 days. So, I mean, that, and to say that that's obviously there's a lot of factors and a lot of ranges that can play into that. But that's really not, it is a lot of money, but for those guys, you know, that could secure the rest of your budget, and that could propel, you know, your film into going to that next budget level. And like I'm not trying to get down on any micro budget filmmaking, but because I mean, that's like my forte. I love like, how can we not do it the cheapest, but like, I mean, geez, you got to get those costs.
Yeah. Get the cost down.
With those micro budgets, you're going to hone your craft. And if you want to try to, you know, those stars will automatically jump your film out of a micro budget capability just because of how much they cost. If you were to try to pursue them, just in terms of like, you know, let's just say you spend an actor $100,000 on an actor. Well, you might have an additional $20,000 to $30,000 other costs, mm-hmm. you know, with different crew, lighting, mm-hmm. you know, green M&Ms, you know, to sure. support that. Or those days that you're shooting with him, so that's a factor you gotta play. But I feel like it's you know, with filmmaking and movies, to go to that next level and to have name talent, you know, it's a that's what it will take in order to take that kind of next baby step, you know, in terms of like maybe then moving on to having a studio or a distributor, you know, trust you with maybe more money and with more name talent, you know, in that next step. And if they can see that, you know, hey, this film with this talent, you know, these guys made this and it turned out great or whatever it was, profitable, you know, different things depending on what you're trying to do. It'll help you just kind of take those steps in a filmmaker's journey if you want to pursue that. So I highly recommend, you know, all the filmmakers listening to this, you know, that can help really be the next little baby step for you in order to take the bigger leap to bigger budgets and bigger, you know, productions. And that's not to say, you know, there's always that wild card, you get lucky and stars, mm-hmm. you know, jump out, which is everyone's dream. But, you know, baby steps sometimes.
But you have to look at it as an ROI. So like if you're spending, you know, $100,000 on a talent, that could justify a $2 million budget. Without that talent, you're looking at a $500,000 budget, you know, for the same movie or less.
Way less.
Or much, much less. You know, so yeah. it all ranges. You have to just kind of think about it. So, you know, if you have Mickey or Dolph in your movie, you've got the movie sold, almost done in pre-sales. And we'll talk about pre-sales in a minute, but it's almost sold automatically because of their there's an automatic market for that kind of talent involved. Yeah. Now, as far as ranges are concerned, I've heard, you know, 50 to 300,000 is a good range, but I know guys who will show up for $5,000 a day and $10,000 sure. a day. And if they go, oh, for a week, give me $25,000 and we're good. And they might not be at the level of the 50, 100, 200,000, but they start peppering the cast. And you can yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the peppering of the cast where you get these known faces? They might not be box office draws, but they're faces. One of the big ones was Trejo for the longest time. And now he's Danny.
And I've gotten to work with Danny. I've always wanted to.
But isn't it by law that he has to be in every movie? I mean, that's law now, isn't it? I mean, he has to be in every movie. Him and Sam Jackson.
Has that been codified? But I think it has. You're right.
I think it has. I think the Supreme Court is checking on that right now. But I think it's Sam Jackson and or Danny Trejo have to be in a movie. That's the law.
If I remember right, the law also states they can't be in the same movie together. Otherwise, the world will be ripped apart.
The space-time continuum explodes. I understand completely. But I remember Danny before, you know, Machete, and he was before he became a leading man, he was the character actor, and he was in, I mean, he's literally in everything. You know, he just shows up. It's fascinating to watch Danny. And he's the first to say, he's like, did you have a check? I'm there. And can I bring my tacos? And he has his own, and that's not racist. He has his own taco company.
I believe.
It's called Trejo's Tacos here in LA. But it was fascinating. So can you talk a bit about the value of peppering some of these more character actor faces in a movie, which kind of also gives you a little bit of weight when trying to go after a bigger fish too? Like, oh, look at all these other guys who've been in a million things.
Yeah. So I would say if I was approaching like a film where we're going to pepper in some recognizable faces, some maybe TV actors. Yes, you'd want to try to get as many of those guys as possible. One of the nice things that if you were to pursue that route, okay, you know, that will help. I always, you know, it's always hard to say like, and then for your next project, but like maybe bigger talent that, you know, for future work that you do, when they look back and they say, okay, well, we've got all these things. Let's see what they've done. Like, okay, well, they've worked with Danny and they've worked with this. And they're like, okay, well, they've worked with some industry people. So sometimes, you know, establishing yourself of being able to work with industry people will help propel that next, you know, also be a little bit of a baby step for you to kind of, if you want to make bigger things. Now, peppering guys in, I would say, yes. I mean, like the more recognizable faces, you know, obviously the better. I would also throw this in with a caveat, like really do your homework and research, because there might be like Danny Trejo. I'm not super familiar with, like, I don't want to put like actors as if they have values, but I know Danny Trejo is super popular in the United States. So like you kind of get a distributor to bite on having a Danny Trejo in the movie.
With that said, can I throw a caveat in there real quick?
Sure. Yeah.
There was a movie. There was a movie that I worked on, which had Eric Roberts in it, and Eric is a face, and distributors generally liked Eric Roberts and do still. Unfortunately, Eric did 25 movies that year. So when the producer went to go sell his movie, every distributor's like, I already got 3 Eric Roberts movies this year. I don't need yours. So there has to be a balance as well. You know, so.
Well, and I think that's why it ties into like, if you're going to pepper it with faces, you know, really do your homework.
Right.
Because you don't want to have, I'm not trying to put down Eric Roberts, but like you said,
yeah, sure.
You don't want to be in the season where there's 25 of his movies already.
Right. He's diluting his value.
So just, you know, do, if you're going to pepper and use some different faces, which can work great and maybe be easier, do your homework, do your research, don't be afraid to call like producers from other films with talent that you're looking at.
Yes.
Call them.
Yes.
Email them. I would love to have someone email or message me, and so I can tell Mickey Rourke stories. I don't mean that like in a bad way, but like I can like, listen, this is what you need to do. This is what you shouldn't do. You know, try to do this. Like, I mean, I feel like, you know, when you're in the filmmaking community, especially the independents, you know, we all have war stories and battle scars, and to be able to help the next person like avoid, you know, like, okay, well, this is a pitfall. Try not to do that if at all possible. You know,
We're Lieutenant Dan, the privates are coming in. It's like, don't salute me. Get down. Do this. You're going to get burned over here. Like, that's who we are, essentially. That's what you're trying to do.
And like, a lot of producers, a lot of us are very much like that. So give those guys a call. Shoot them an email message. They'll shoot you straight, because, you know, at the end of the day, the younger filmmakers, like, you don't want to say like who you help could be the next whoever, but like it really could be beneficial, you know, to just relay some information and cause you paid for it in blood, sweat, and tears. So, you know, don't let it die. Don't let it sink with the ship.
So
at least that's my thing.
So with that said, can you tell some Mickey Rourke stories or Dolph Lundgren stories that are appropriate for the show and that won't blacklist you from the industry?
Oh boy. Okay, so a quick Mickey Rourke story. So one of the things when Mickey Rourke first showed up on my set, or at least when he showed up on our shooting location, he arrived late at night, and me and my other producing partner went to go meet him, and we brought his costumes and everything. And Mickey Rourke, he enters the hotel and he looks right at us, and he walked right on past us. And his assistant, yeah. And we were like, because we had the costumes. So we assumed like, okay, we must fit the film. I mean, we said that we were going to be there with the film, and you know, we're like, well, maybe he didn't see us. I don't know. Like, what's going on? And later his like assistant came out of the hotel and just said, look, we need the costumers here. We don't want to see the producers. We're like, oh, okay. Well, okay, fine. And so we get the costumers in there. They're doing their thing. And later on, like, I can't remember if it was later that night or early in the morning, we find out like Mickey would not like to have the producers on set. If Mickey sees the producers again, he's going to punch them in the face. And we're like, and not leave his trailer. And we're like, okay, so like literally the whole day when he was shooting, we were hiding in like a back room, and I was a little bit younger then, so I like, and I was actor in the movie, so I scrubbed up my face and I went in with the grips to go meet him. So I met Mickey Rourke as a grip on my own film production, so that way I didn't get punched in the face or have him not leave his trailer.
You hear stories about actors not leaving trailers and you know, being difficult sometimes on set, and you hear these mythical stories. You're like, this can't really be true, and I go, no, it can.
Now, to back that up, Mickey was he got through the day. We got all of his stuff shot. He was working great with the director. Mm-hmm. He's working great with the cast members, and I don't know if it was more of like just. You know, sometimes actors, they like to say or do things just to see if they can get away with it or just whatever. But, you know, as the producer, you don't want to take that chance. A, I didn't want my face punched, and B, I didn't want him to not leave his set or trailer. So
let me ask you, on a producing standpoint, just on a legal standpoint, if I'm paying somebody $500,000, $250,000, and they do not perform the service I hired them to do, meaning like they are doing things that are creating havoc or not coming out of their trailer. I always wondered, there has to be some sort of legal ramification for this kind of behavior, right? Or if you don't want to answer that, please don't. I don't want to put you in a bad spot.
I don't know. I don't think that's a bad spot. I mean, obviously you have a contract with them, and there's obviously some stipulations, and one of them primarily is being that they have to act.
I mean, to be fair,
you know, that's where it kind of can get really gray. Like if they show up to set and they do a scene or two and then they start making demands and they don't get the day done. I mean, it can get really gray. I mean, it really can with some of these things. Like, I'll just say, for instance, like state law might dictate like, or wherever you're shooting might say like, listen, you can only work a normal 8-hour day or SAG rules. Mm-hmm. They only earn eight hour day. They might do 8 hours and then say, hey, I'm out. I did my day. So, I mean, I've never experienced that myself where an actor has not, you know, they're more, you know, if you treat them well,
mm-hmm. with respect.
With respect, you're doing everything that you can in order to, I don't want to say accommodate them, but you know, just like they want to work and they know the situation of like what, you know, like maybe you have them for 3 days. They know this and they have so much they got to do. And they're more than willing. If you treat them with respect, if you're accommodating, if you're, you know, go out of your way to, you know, make sure that they have a good time, just in terms of like experience set, you know, they will go that extra mile for you because they are those. I mean, they're the artists. They want their work to be good. They want to look good on camera. So,
did you ever hear the story of Marlon Brando on the set of The Score with De Niro and Ed Norton?
Oh, I want to say that I have, but please tell it. I'm sure it's going to.
Because, Marlon Brando is legendary for being difficult. I mean, even The Godfather, he was being difficult because he was already Marlon Brando when he did The Godfather. And he was on this movie called The Score, which was directed by Frank Oz. Now, for many people who don't know who Frank Oz is, he's a very well-known director, but he also is known for being the voice of Yoda and also being the voice of he puppeted Kermit the Frog. He came up as a Muppet, you know, a puppeteer. And Marlon refused to even let him be on the set. Now, when those two forces, like the director and Marlon Brando, Marlon's like, I'm not acting if that puppet director and, you know, expletive is there, I'm not going to work. So De Niro had to direct Brando on the set while poor Frank Oz was in a trailer radioing the directions to Robert. And Robert's like, come on, Marlon. And he's like, no, I'm not going to work. Bobby, I'll work with you. Ed, I'll work with you. I can't work with this puppet director. This puppet guy, this frog effer. And all sorts of stuff he was saying. But I heard this story and you just like, and I've heard it multiple times from different people. And you're just like, that's where this stuff happens. This is where these myths start coming, like people becoming difficult. But also once you do that once, this is a small business and everyone hears it. And the next, so, you know, when you're Marlon Brando, you're Marlon Brando. Like, what are you going to do? It's Marlon Brando.
Right.
But, you know, when you're an actor, you know, a paycheck actor, meaning that you got to work to keep the bills coming, you can't be pulling that kind of stuff for the most part.
Yeah. And for the most part, they don't. But if you have a situation like that, you find yourself in with like a Marlon Brando type of situation, you got to pick your battles. And at the end of the day, at least in terms of a producer, like you just got to get their footage. You got to get them shot. You got to get their face on camera, get their scenes. Much, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, just that's it.
And they know that, you know, the actors know that. So, you know, they're being difficult because they know you got to get them shot. So I shouldn't say they're being difficult just because of that. But, you know, you got to pick your battles. And sometimes you got to, you know, you got to have Robert De Niro directing with.
Now, I mean, do you find it that a lot of named actors and seasoned actors in general will test the director, will test the production, will test to see how far they can push something sometimes just to see what happens?
I would say yes. So always be prepared for that. But at the same time, like, they're doing that because they want to see how quality you are. Like, right. do you wither under pressure, or is this like a real thing? You know, so don't, you know, be hesitant to speak your mind and you know, challenge them right back potentially. Not like in a bad way.
No, absolutely. Like,
they will test every once in a while. So be prepared for that. But, you know, really for the most part, like right off the bat, to avoid like the testing is to, like, if it's the director, the producer, whoever it is with the main talent, like, go try to establish a rapport. They're almost always, if they sign on to your project, they want to talk to the director. They want to know, like, go pick them up at the airport. You know, like, you be, if it's all possible, and I'm talking about maybe more of the director, but like, be there, talk. I mean, then they have to talk to you in the car and you can tell funny jokes. And, you know, if they've written a book, read the book, you know, so you can talk about their book, you know, talk about things that they enjoy and like. Because at the end of the day, we're all human beings, and, you know, they approach, like, we're like, maybe for us as independent filmmakers, movies are lives. Like, this is my life. This is what I do. But for them, you know, they've been maybe more established in their career. Like, this is their job. So, and sometimes people don't like to talk about their jobs. They like to talk about dogs. They like to talk about their cars. But, you know what I mean? Like about talk about just things, and just kind of establishing that right away with them, that you're, you know, not that the film's secondary, but like, you really are excited to have them there and you just want to connect as a, you know, hey, let's just talk about, you know, funny stories and this and that. And that will really loosen them up to be like, okay, they're artistic, you know, because at the end of the day, these are artists. And artists have a tendency be to really, you know, like the shy can be very shy people, very, you know, personal people. And to be able to make them feel comfortable is so important. And it honestly will diffuse a lot of the issues that you might have with problems, because if they feel comfortable, you know, then they're free to express themselves as artists.
Yeah, that's my feeling as well. That actors is a general statement, but let alone high profile actors, they want to feel safe. They want to feel that they're in good hands as a director, speaking from a director's point of view. And at the second that they see that there's some buffoonery going on, or they don't feel that the director's got their back, or they're not safe, that's when the acting up happens. That's where I've seen that happen. And they start – because they're defending themselves. They're like, you know what? If this guy's not going to take care of me, if this girl's not going to take care of me, then I'm going to take care of myself, and this is how I'm going to do it.
Yeah. And I always say, like, anyone can put up with anything for one day. No, that's not to say that you need to abuse people by any means. But, like, anyone can put up with anything for a day. So, you know, like when it comes to just, you know, be up front and like – if you're having issues on set, I mean, right, with the thing, like, go to the actor, apologize, say, hey, we'll work on, you know, just
work it out.
It was because, honestly, like, they'll put up with it if they know that you're, you know, they know that they're not on a studio set.
Right.
And that's not to put down what you're doing by any means. They understand. And if you are, you know, responsive to them as such, of being cordial, that you won't have any issues.
Did you ever listen to that that VO session with Orson Welles? That legendary VO session with Orson. You have heard that one? Isn't that brilliant? For everyone listening, Orson Welles did a VO session for, I think, some sort of commercial, some wine commercial or something. And this poor VO director, oh my God, he just ripped him for like 30 minutes. It was like a train wreck. You couldn't look away.
Like that with the Christian Bale and the
that was brutal. Now let me see. Do you have any other fun stories? Dolph story, Ron Perlman story.
I can tell. So one fun Dolph Lundgren story is, and this will kind of tie in with, we're shooting with Dolph, and I happen to be in a scene with him as well, and we are knife fighting. So we only had Dolph come in for we were doing a knife fight, and we didn't have any practice space, and he was only available for 2 hours. So we literally brought him into the production office, this little like 12x6 to block the knife fight. So we're with everyone else running around blocking the knife fight, and I was literally like on the phone with SAG like right before I was supposed to talk to him. They told me, and I won't go into the details, but basically I still needed to get the actors cleared. So they let me know I need to get the actors cleared, and then I had to knife fight Dolph. And then as soon as I got done knife fighting Dolph in the 20 minutes we did our steps, I had to get back on the phone with SAG to try to clear, you know, the actors and Dolph to actually be in the film. So that was kind of a fun – he was – and like, for, you know, obviously Dolph knows what he's doing in terms of action.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're like in a production office, like basically a little room. Everyone's copiers going, and we're blocking our knife fight scene. And I'm just thinking this whole time, like, there's no way that he's – not that he couldn't remember it, but, like, there's no way this is going to look good. Or, you know, like, we shot it 7 days later, and he knew it – he knew that knife fight, like, as if he had been practicing it for, like, you know, months to prepare for it, and, like, knew every step. And it was just like – like, he knew it, and we literally had 20 minutes in an office. So I thought that was just
– professional. I mean,
talk about a professional.
So let's talk about financing, because, you know, this is all sounds great. You know, we got a great script. You've talked to the actors. The agents are happy. You know, they're ready to go. Then there's that whole money thing. You've got to pay them and also have money for the budget of the film. Yeah. First of all, how do you finance the film? How do you finance most of your films, and what part of pre-sales come into that? And secondly, when you're trying to lock in an actor, a lot of times they need proof of funds or something along that line, correct?
Correct, yes. So at least for me, and kind of what I've gotten blessed to be able to do is with pre-sales movies. And, you know, kind of your – so the financing then and the distribution in a pre-sales movie are kind of tied hand in hand. So let's say we'll use Mickey Rourke as an example. You might go to a distributor and say, hey, if I get Mickey Rourke in this movie, so let's take it, say it's a horror movie. And if I get Mickey Rourke attached to this movie, what do you think that's worth? What would you give me? And they might come back to you and say, hey, we'll give you $100,000 to distribute your movie. And so you take that kind of offer and you go and say that's in the United States. And then you go to Germany and say, hey, if I have this horror movie with Mickey Rourke in it, what would you give me? And they say, nah, they'll give you $10,000. Okay, great. $10,000. So right now you got 110. And then you go, so you go to different territories potentially and say, hey, to distributors there and say, hey, what will you give me? And maybe you add all that up to say, let's say $500,000. Okay. So then you, my friend, have not necessarily, I mean, there's some more steps in there, but here you've got $500,000 worth of value with your movie and Mickey Rourke. Okay. So while that might not be money, that is worth something. Now, that's probably worth something to say, like, hey, we could actually probably approach Mickey Rourke. Well, assuming you hadn't maybe approached Mickey Rourke to do the movie in the first place. Mm. Let's like, okay, now we know we actually can have some money if we have Mickey Rourke in this movie. So then you go to Mickey Rourke and say, hey, what would it take for you to do this movie? You know, you make him offer, bam, bam, bam. So, you know, and then so once you connect the two, pre-sales and we'll just say Mickey Rourke, then you can go to, there's a couple options for you. You can go to a bank of Los Angeles. I mean, I don't want to say like a Los Angeles bank. Any bank will do it. But like a bank could, you could take these pre-sales with the actor attached and say, hey, how much will you with this, with these kind of offers, how much is the, like, would you loan against that? And they might say, hey, we'll give you, you know, $300,000. So there's your money. There's $300,000 to make a movie. Now you got to go out and find maybe $200,000 more, or maybe you've got, I don't want to say you've got $200,000 in your pocket, but then you got it, you know, so automatically your ability to then kind of go out to investors, you know, you've just added, you know, if you go out to investors and you only need, that's way easier to raise maybe $200,000 than it is to raise $500,000. And opposed to even having to raise, you know, the budget of your movie without having any of these things, mm-hmm. you know, an actor or any sales beforehand.
So two things. One, yeah. I thought pre-sales is more rarer nowadays than it used to be. Before, you really could do exactly what you're saying with it doesn't even need to be at a caliber of Mickey Rourke. How do you feel that the today's not literally today because we're in an upside down, but pre-COVID, like, you know, just late 2019, what was the world like for pre-sales? And is it, have you seen it become harder or easier?
I think it's been better. It's been bigger. I think the giant myth is that pre-sales are no longer a thing. Now, the actual value amount of what your pre-sales can be is down. Yes, that is true. And that's where like the value is down, but like that's where if you're like a micro budget filmmaker, that's where your value as being able to do that has just increased.
Right.
Because you know how to do things way cheaper than maybe someone else knew how to do it 10 years ago because the values have come down. And that, in my opinion, is across the board like on everything. And that has primarily to do with the DVD market just shrinking. And they haven't been able to completely monetize VOD, or, you know,
streaming.
VOD. Yeah. As soon as your movie goes, you know, on the internet, it's, or even released on DVD or released anywhere, it's Pirate City and everyone watches it for free. You know what I mean?
Give or take.
Yeah. It's just now it's available for free and now you're fighting Pirate City. So that's the part that's the hard thing.
So then we've got this whole chicken and egg situation where if you go to Mickey Rourke's people and go, hey, look, what would it take? Well, we want 250, but I'm sure Mickey's getting hit up by producers in this. I've heard this. I've seen this happen. He gets hit up by producers daily and they just want his name to go raise the funding. Now, but a lot of them, they will not let you attach their name to the project unless they see verifications of them. So you kind of like need that money first in order to attach a Mickey Rourke, in order to then go off and get pre-sales to get, you know, it's kind of like, so how does that work in today's world with you?
Yeah. So it literally, and that does sound convoluted and complicated, and it's almost circular. Mm-hmm. And my answer to that is yes.
Okay.
And it literally, I mean, it's a fine dance. And I would that's why I'd like bringing in, having maybe someone a little bit experienced and being able to do that, mm-hmm. is very valuable to your project. Not that they, because it literally is that. I mean, that is the film system in a nutshell, in a smaller world. Because, like, I'll let you in on a secret of Hollywood. And Alex, you probably know this. No one has any money. Shh,
that's
don't
right.
Tell
no one does.
Don't tell anyone. And so, but I think that's a basis to start with. And when you know this, okay, it makes it a lot easier to work in the circle to try to get the money to make a project. Because everyone, that's a basic building block of films, is no one has any money. And everyone secretly knows this. And so that's why it's like, okay, you know, a Mickey Rourke might say, okay, we won't let you attach your name unless you have the money. And then you can kind of softly then approach someone with money to get the money because Mickey Rourke's softly attached. And then it's all kind of tied together. And you just kind of keep working. You just keep working it in a circle until it all comes together.
So
I wish it was simpler.
Oh, it should be.
It should be, but like I've done several of these now, and each time I'm just like, it's just so easy. You just it works in a circle, and you just got to keep the circle going.
Right.
Because if it stops, things will fall apart.
Right. If the music stops, you're going to run out of chairs.
Yes.
What's the old joke in Hollywood? How do you get a small fortune? And how do you make a small fortune in Hollywood?
Oh, I don't know this.
How do you make a small fortune in Hollywood? You start with a large fortune.
Start with a large, yeah. Isn't that the truth?
I mean, it's insane. Now, one thing about actors, and I have a lot of experience with this, and I would love to hear your point of view and if this is actually a thing, but I my feeling is it isn't. But letters of intent. What the hell is it really worth? Is it worth anything? Is it just it's just kind of fluff? You know, because I remember when I was, you know, in my first book about making a movie with a mobster, we have this actor's letter of intent, and we had Oscar-winning actors' letters of intent, and we never got money. It doesn't really mean anything from my point of view. I'd love to hear yours.
Yeah. I would say, like, to have an actor with a letter of intent, the value to that is if you've had someone, and I'm just going to say like a director that has worked with that actor with the letter of intent, because then automatically, you know, it's a like, it'll tell investors or like a financing bank that that's a real thing.
Because there's a relationship there.
There is. I mean, yes.
So if you all of a sudden have a letter of intent from Dolph and from Mickey to be in a movie, and that's what you have, you can go to investors like, well, he's already done movies with them, so this is a real thing.
Yeah, this is a real thing. Yes. Yes. And that's why I hate to say, like, you need someone kind of like that on your project. It's super helpful. It's very helpful because – and not that those guys would then do it because this person's in the project. But like it adds to that level of – I want to say the showman. Like believability. But
No. It's a showman. It's a smoke and mirrors. It's smoke and mirrors. You kind of like look over here. Look at the dance.
That circle going. You got to keep that circle going. And if – you know, like if – have someone that has worked – I mean, like I'll give you an example. Like I could message like probably – I'm going to say Mickey Rourke just because I know he's switched agents, but in the past, like I could at least message Mickey Rourke's agent and say like, hey, I am doing this project and this is Mickey Rourke even available? And he would get back to me because A, you know, we've paid him for something, and he would at least respond. Mm-hmm. And he would say like, oh, Mickey's schedule is, you know, not available for 9 months. or whatever that is. And that's why I like having that kind of value of a producer or someone attached to the project that has that ability is so helpful, because it kind of cuts through all the BS right away. And you can know, like, I mean, it's not that Mickey Rourke's not interested in your project. It's because he's just not even available. I mean, he could be, you know, on vacation. So, you know, then you can move on. You're not wasting time.
Fair enough. It makes perfect sense. Now, with the distributor and pre-sales, when you, in your experience, when you're getting MGs, so essentially you're getting MGs basically before. You're not just giving the movie and doing a profit participation.
I call it kind of like you said, like promise letters. Pay you this once the movie's finished.
But they are paying you once the movie's finished. So it's not like this.
Correct.
Is,
yeah.
These aren't not speculation. It's not what are those called? What they think the movie's going to make.
This could be worth. Yeah.
No, yeah.
This would be
cash. Know. Cash in the pocket. Yeah. Right. So after that cash in the pocket comes in, you're hoping that all the cash that you're going to make off of the initial MGs is going to be not only enough to pay back your budget, but also maybe make a nice little profit. Because do you actually see back end? Do you actually, you know, with the way distribution is worked and the whole system is played out? I know. Just say, Alex, I don't feel comfortable asking.
I think this is a great answer. Okay. So they always say in when you're trying to do distribution, whatever you're going to make, if they offer you, let's just say $20,000, that's all the money you'll ever see.
Right.
And I would say that, like, you can take that saying to the bank every single time. Right. Because barring that, if your film is like a sensational hit or a hit, and then maybe you'll see some more money later on, like down the road, like maybe 2 or 3 years later. And I'm not saying that's a lot of money, but like you'll see some royalties come in maybe 2 or 3 years later down the road. But whatever they're going to offer you up front is about all they'll see. I mean, all you're going to see from whatever that territory is, or let's just say US, just to make things simple.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, whatever that MG is.
If they're offering you no money, mm-hmm, and they're going to pay you out off of, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that deal. Just know that you will not, just put that in your brain, you will not see any money ever.
That's what I've been yelling for the top of the mountains for a while now.
I know you have. You say in all your shows. And for those that are listening, like, I listen to Alex's shows like from the beginning. So I've taken a lot of his advice to heart. So start at episode one, and then, you know, I think, what are you on to? Maybe
300 and something like that. We're getting close to 400 now, sir.
Listen to all of them. They all are relevant. And you can stop buying, and then you can be done. You'll learn everything now. No. So very important. But yes, I mean, please, 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 please. And that's to say, like, if they're offering you just to distribute your film without paying you something up front, you won't see any money. I mean, the odds of you seeing any money are very, very slim. And so, like, and maybe I don't mean to paint doom and gloom on that scenario, because maybe, you know, obviously you want to try to make money off your movie, but maybe that just – but literally the act of getting distribution for your movie,
right,
has its own value. That means something when you're ready to make a second one or a third one.
Take it on the chin. You might have to take it on the chin.
Take it on the chin.
On the first –
You might have to take it on the chin. So just realize that if you're in that situation, you might have to take it on the chin in order to get that distribution, because that act of distribution literally will help you on the next one. That's 100%. It 100% will help.
Right. But, so if you get picked up by Lionsgate or, you know, Warner Home Movies or, you know, or one of these distribution companies like that are upper echelon, not lower end echelon, but higher echelon.
But even lower guys, I mean, just that act of being able to get, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things where they always say, like, well, I can get your movie in Walmart. You know, that might not equal any dollars, but it means something.
Or theatrical, or limited theatrical.
Don't even.
What do you think about limited theatrical? Well, I mean, obviously right now theatrical is a big question mark. But before COVID?
Like, forget theatrical. Like, if they're trying to tantalize you with limited theatrical, that means they'll play it in, if they play it at all, I mean, if they actually do it, they'll play it in 10 cities and they'll run it on a weekend in some small theater that no one, they won't have any press about to play. I mean, it will be limited. And
they one screening somewhere.
Use that as a way then to charge you, you know, a lot of money in expenses. So
he just used air quotes for people not watching this. There was air
sorry,
quotes.
I forgot. Yes, I put expenses in air quotes. And but I will throw if saying that, okay? A theatrical run, a limited theatrical run, could help the film out in order to get on Netflix, let's just say.
Right. And how about for foreign? How about for foreign if it's a U.S. limited?
For foreign. Just depending. So, you know, so maybe you got to take that on the chin as well.
So I want to be very clear about this, everyone listening. You, the way that you're making money with your films is by stacking the cast with value that has pre-sale value to distribution companies around the world in different territories. If you don't have that that valuable cast, pre-sale value cast, you won't sell your movie. You won't get any pre-sale money. You won't, not pre-sale money, but you won't even get any offers. You will get no MGs. And then now you're in the world of, I'm going to donate my film, a non-tax deductible donation to a film distributor. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, yes, but I, like I said, like maybe that's what you have to do in order to take that next step on the next one. I'm speaking maybe more for those micro-budget filmmakers out
right.
there.
Yeah, you don't want to throw a $1 million movie.
Yeah, I mean, if you make a film for $5,000 and you're able to go through all these steps and get distribution, and even if you're not going to make any money, dude, you're only out $5,000 and you get distribution on your movie, that's huge. That means someone in the distribution world sees value, at least enough for them to even just put on this. They have to spend a little bit of money to put your stuff out there. Like, that's a huge deal, and don't let that discourage you, you know. And you're only out, you'd only be out $5,000, which is like huge. Because when you get into that, you know, let's say $100,000 plus, I mean, you could be in the exact same boat except be out $100,000.
Right. That's why my first film cost me about $5,000 and I got it sold to Hulu and sold it overseas and you know, got it on different platforms and stuff. And it was $5,000. My last film was $3,000 and I got distribution for that. I was like, okay, great.
And it's a big deal because, you know, like it would, that helps for things like when you approach talent or investors.
Right.
And they're like, okay, well, at least he got a film to the distribution's point. Like, we know it got out there to start selling. I mean, there might be some things that an investor might not totally understand, but they definitely understand, like, hey, his last movie at least got to distribution, and I can actually watch it on a physical, like, I don't want to say DVD, but they can actually see it come to market. And that's a huge deal. Get the film to market.
How important are film markets to your process? Like AFM can.
I mean, I think they're important. You know, for the producer in me hates them because all it is just a bunch of added expense, in my opinion, that film will have to go through, especially in today's world when you can like send out a screener out to just about anyone and they can watch the film and check out, they can see it from their home. And if they want to buy it, they'll go after it. If not, they won't. But it is, for the industry, you know, sometimes it's that showmanship factor. That, you know, you got to be in that game to some extent in order to be taken seriously. That's not to say that you're not a serious person, but that's still that part of that Hollywood.
It's perception. You know, it's perception.
Keepers.
Yeah, it's
and to
perception.
Be there at a market, you know, with maybe an established sales rep, selling your film, you know, helps, you know, well, helps you in your filmmaking journey and career. That might not necessarily be financially, but it does help.
Do you use sales reps?
I do.
But these are pre-built relationships that of sales rep that you actually trust.
Yes. Yeah. I've got, honestly, like I've got one go-to sales rep team that I use for like all of my stuff. And mm-hmm. I've had that relationship since the first movie that I've ever had. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, if I can give a piece of advice to like being able to establish, I think there's like a misconception about sales reps that is partially true, but also built upon, you know, like just the nature of the beast. Mm-hmm. First approaching a sales rep and you're, I don't want to say a nobody, but like you don't have anyone in your movie. You don't, you know, it's maybe not a genre that's super sellable. And if they take you on, you know, like there's a lot of, you know, like that movie will have a hard time selling. Like it's just, you know, my family's in does real estate. Like I always did real estate. And one of the things that I've always learned is that, listen, I can get up and you can price your house at this price. At the end of the day, I still got to show the house and someone's still got to buy it. So if it's not the house, you know what I mean? Like if the house is not worth it, the buyers will let you know. And so a sales rep company, they'll give you all of the lights, the showmanship and the lights and glamour and the estimates. But at the end of the day, your movie has to sell. Like it's your product that they're selling. They can't sell it for you. Now, obviously there's some things that they can do to, you know, like help, mm-hmm. but like at the end of the day, it's the product. So my piece of advice then is like, just realize that like it's your product. So sometimes that doesn't mean it's bad, but like then so pick a sales rep for your project that you feel maybe comfortable with and trying to build and establish that relationship. And then, and also realize that maybe they're not going to they're not going to make me any money off this movie. But you know what? That 10-year relationship potential that you could develop with them will pay off in dividends. Just because obviously, you know, like you'll establish that rapport. They know you're a filmmaker that can deliver a movie, mm-hmm. you know, then you kind of go, maybe the next one you have a talent. Well, then all of a sudden you're like, they know you're a filmmaker that can deliver with talent and they'll help push you and they'll help guide you into things to help your career along. They will be there for you. But you gotta build that relationship with them. It can't be a, here's my product, how about you sell it? And when they don't do that, then you burn the house down and you leave. I mean, now saying all those things, like, mm-hmm. yes, there are predators out there, and that's why it's so important to call other producers. But you know, there's a lot of really great established sales reps, and you just wanna, you know, go in there thinking, hey, I wanna people to sell my movie. I want to start a relationship with them.
You know, I think because I know a lot of sales reps as well. I know the handful that are. I know a handful of good ones. I got ripped off by one early on in my career. Episode, I think number 2 or 3 of the show was me ranting about producers reps and sales reps because I was stole 10 grand off of me back in the day. But I feel that a lot of times that producers reps and sales reps get bad raps is they'll pick up a movie that has no talent, quote unquote, no marketable talent, and they try to do their best, and it generally the market will say no. But if you show up with a movie with Dolph or Raw or Ron Perlman or someone of, you know, some sort of marketable talent, it makes their job a lot easier. They can pick up the call and call Germany, call 2 or 3 buyers in Germany and go, I got a Mickey Rourke movie here. What can you give me for it? And that's why you hire someone like that, because they have those automatic connections to all of these buyers around the world that you just don't.
Yeah, and they'll play ball with you. So like if your first film totally tanks just because of the – you know, not because it's a bad movie. It's just because it just didn't have the glitz and the glamour that it takes for a distributor to sell, you know, to the best of their ability. You know, if you do approach them with like, hey, I've got this horror film that if we had Mickey Rourke, the distributor might go, whoa, let me make some calls for you. Mm-hmm. Right there. And you got a guy I'd work in it.
Exactly. Now, which leads us to my final question, COVID-19 and how production is going to be moving forward, how the film markets are being affected, what you think in your personal opinion from being a veteran in the business. How do you think things are going to move moving forward? Like, and I know nobody knows the answer to this, but I just like to hear your opinion about, first of all, production and then also film markets, because I don't know about you. Like, I'm not going to AFM this year, even if I'm invited. I'm like, I'm not going to a public event in 2020, yeah. Pretty much. So how can you do a film market without just hundreds of thousands of people grouped in together.
If you want my opinion, now, granted, this is my opinion. And let me give you some background. I'm a history major by trade.
Okay.
So I always approach things just naturally because it's who I am by looking into the past to predict the future.
Okay.
That's just –
Sound advice, sir.
Okay. So my advice would be history has always rewarded the bold. And this is an opportunity for the bold to
–
I mean I'm not recommending that you go out there and make your movie, you know,
put people at risk.
I mean, safe or all of these things. But I mean, there, a whole industry is ground to a halt. And those that are willing to go out and
be creative,
practice and craft and create will be rewarded. That's just my opinion. So, and, you know, and I'm not saying, you know, like that's a, so that's my right now. I think eventually if we looked into the future, I think like productions will limp along here this fall, like in terms of just what's happening, like they'll try to make some things work. I think by next year, this will all be in our rear view mirror. Hopefully. I think things will be back on track. Mm-hmm. I think we'll see a giant spike in, you know, profitability potential off of VOD because a lot of people are staying at home and getting used to watching now things on TV and streaming. I think that will only help boost the streaming markets from into the future. And so that will be, which is great for independent films, because that's been the one area that's been a real big hit on just our ability to make income from our work. I think unfortunately, you know, theaters will have a really hard time, you know, but I always foresee like the big tentpole movies, the big budget stuff, you know, the Marvel movies. I think that's the only way to really experience them.
I agree.
That relief. So the theaters will be okay, but I do think it will, you know, it's hard to be profitable as an independent doing theaters anyways. I think it just will be a real death sentence to like, don't even bother taking it to theaters. That's not to say that there's not some allure to it, you know.
But also, and I'll play devil's advocate here. If there isn't a lot of studio product for all these screens, there might be opportunities for independents to come in. Because honestly, beforehand, the studios are only making 30 movies a year, 40 movies a year.
You've got a lot of great videos on how to market and distribute your movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is, especially with theaters, there's a giant missed opportunity to just focus in on theaters and marketing your film and mm-hmm. keeping it in that world. And I mean, that's its own like.
Oh, no, it's its own thing. And I've had guests on who've made millions. Millions theatrically, yeah. Self-distributing and four-walling and booking their own theaters. And it's a thing, but it's a lot of work. And it's a
lot of work. And if you're most creatives like to do their project, get it out there, and then move on. And that's why it's hard to, you know, like live in your film for another 2 years that could take or whatever, you know what I mean.
Oh no, I've been trying to tell people like the real work starts at the end of the cut. That's when the real work starts. Like the hardest part is not getting the movie made. The hardest part is getting the money back.
Yeah. Well, and so Alex, that's why with the pre-sales that we've kind of been talking about,
mm-hmm.
if you can do that process of you know, attaching the talent to the, you're doing a lot of work and that's circular. But you're doing it almost before you start shooting, mm-hmm. As opposed to after. And so, like the same, it's the same amount of work, except that you're taking that you're taking that risk away from what you're trying to do, and you're putting it on the front end. And so that's why it's, in my opinion, if you're able as a filmmaker to be able to get to that point where you can like, okay, hey, we're going to raise – that's why the distribution and the financing, you can tie together and put it towards the front end of you trying to make a movie, because then you could spend 2 years in that circular motion.
Oh.
And it's way better to do that than to have – done the 6 months in pre-production trying to raise the money, scrape out money, shoot the film, post-production, and then spend 2 years trying to sell it. And it's just
– you want to hedge your bets. Yeah, you just want to hedge your bets if you can. It's like, you know, when Apple creates an iPhone, they know that they have a market, they have an infrastructure, they have sale – you know, they know that they're going to recoup whatever money they spent to make or design or invent that product. Filmmakers never think about that. They're the only business – when I use the term business, it's very loosely in show business. But we're the only product that's like, I'm going to go spend $500,000 and then figure out how I'm going to get my money back. There's no other business that does that.
Yeah. No, and it's very true. And that's why if you can take that, the business side of things, and throw that in on the front end of your movie, mm-hmm. you know, this will make your life not easier, but it'll be more enjoyable. You'll enjoy the product and so much. I mean, not that you're not going to have stress, but man, it's a lot easier to, you know, only have to worry about maybe, you know, 10% of your budget coming back as opposed to like 100% of your budget coming back.
Even just breaking even is a win.
Right. It's a win. It's a complete win. Yeah. Don't, you know, if you break even on your movie, that is a win. 100% win.
Like, again, no other business. No other business is that a win.
Yeah. But, you know, here's the other secret. Like, you keep at it long enough and you will have that product catapult. And I mean, one of the things I know we didn't really talk about, or maybe like investors, mm-hmm. but one of the things I always like to tell investors is like, listen, maybe it's not this movie. I'm asking you for this. And this is why, you know, this is going to work. And maybe it's not this movie that we make a lot of money on, but it's going to help us get to that next level. And then when we get to that next level, maybe, you know, I'm going to ask you for more money, and maybe it's not that movie that's going to make us the money.
But I'll get your money back. You'll get on the red carpet. You'll get to meet some stars.
And then when we get to that next level, I'm going to ask you for even more money, but that'll be the point where we're going to
take off
really, really well. And you know what? An investor can see that, because it's just like any business. They understand the risks. And if they see like, hey, this person has got a plan and a future, and they know where they're going, and they know that this is, you know, you're not an investor. I shouldn't say they're not worried about 20%, because they are. But like, they're investing in movies. There's a lot of glitz and glamour, but they want to have the huge hit where this, you know what I mean? Like, that's why they're investing in
your movie. The upsell, the upside.
Yeah. You have to explain that to them. Like, that is your goal as well. But it might not, you know, like, it might not be the project that you're making for them right there at that moment, but you have to take those steps in order to get there. That's the only way. It's the only way to be able to proceed forward.
Fair
enough.
And
they'll respect that. They'll see that. They'll respect that. And it'll add that level of like, I've solidly will invest in these steps that maybe we're going to take.
Very cool. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions. I ask all my guests, as you know, if you've listened to the show, what these are. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Collaborate. Collaborate. The film, filmmaking is such a collaborative business at all levels. And, you know, even collaborate with everyone on your team. I mean, we all know if you look at the back end of the credits, there's hundreds of people that work on your film, and collaborate with as many, you know, of all the people that, you know, all the people that'll help you make your film and your project, collaborate with them. They're going to have good ideas. They're going to have bad ideas. Roll with it. Take it. Let it sink in. And then it's like producers, all this stuff, because it's an art form. It's like molding clay. You know, there's things that will happen. You got to collaborate, and you got to trust those around you to be immersed in that process. And I think of all the things that, you know, filmmakers have a tendency to lose is just that art. I mean, they don't forget it. They don't forget about the art form, but that art takes others, especially in our business, and bring you know, other people's, you know, art to life with them, and it will just. There'll be magic there. I mean, that's where the magic's created. So collaborate, collaborate, collaborate.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Perseverance. Mm. Persevere. Don't give up. Don't stop. you're going to have so many pitfalls in life, in filmmaking, and they're going to seem like instrumental hurdles. And maybe at that moment in time, it's going to seem insurmountable. But with some time and persistence and patience, like, you'll get past those things. Life will go on. Things will keep moving forward. It's just like this COVID-19. I'm literally sitting here just like, I have a couple projects that were literally, I was on a movie that I'm producing that I literally had just driven to Montana the day before pre-production was supposed to get started in March to start shooting, like for pre-production to start. And that's when the national emergency started and all the dominoes started falling. Everything was put on hold. And I just was like, oh my gosh, we're just like at that point, this movie is going to get made. Mm-hmm. And it was the day before the movie was supposed to get made. You know what I mean? Like where everything would have been sealed, done. So I only tell that because like you just got to be patient. Your timing will come. Your moment will be there. And you just got to be ready for it. And I think that's hard, especially in our business, to be able to just, you know, sit still. So
three of your favorite films of all time.
Okay, so I know you asked this to everybody, and I was like, I have a list of like art films. I was like, oh, that are my favorite, but and not that I don't want to give those. But I was like, I want to like talk to Lord of the Rings.
Okay. Which one? Which one? The whole thing?
Fellowship of the Ring.
Okay.
That was the first time I sat in a theater and I saw when the hobbits and everyone are going across the. I'd read the book, but I had seen the book come to life. And I just sat back. I was like, I want to do this. I want to make this. Whatever this is, I want to do that. So that was a big deal to me. Probably the other one is Star Wars, no. Empire Strikes Back. I know I'm giving like generic big budget ones, but you know, like just the, like ones that I watch all the time. And then a World War II movie called Kelly's Heroes.
Yeah, I remember Kelly's Heroes. Yeah,
but it is a comedy. It's so funny. And I would recommend if you have not seen Kelly's Heroes, watch Kelly's Heroes. It's like the best combination of story, you know, historical accuracy, actors, and comedy. It's great. Donald Sutherland's in it.
It's fun. It's a good flick. I remember it. And now where can people find you?
Like in terms of how they can get a hold of
your personal address, if you could, and phone number. No, I'm joking. But how can people find you online, sir? If you want to even put that information out there.
Yeah. Just get my wallet out and here you go. Just for people that are going to see the video, you got to sneak.
Social security card will be fine.
Everything. probably the best way is, you know, IMDb me, mm-hmm. Stephen Luke on there. I think I got my email on there. Shoot me a message, you know, say hi, check in. I'm always open to give advice, especially via email. I mean, that's easy. I say that because I have a lot of stuff going on and email is kind of the best way for me to keep track of like, not what I said, but like, oh yeah, okay. I tune myself back into maybe a conversation better that way. So that's probably the best way to get a hold of me. You know, some of my stuff is on, I'd recommend, you know, I'll do a shout out. Like, some of my stuff is on Amazon Prime. Give it a watch. I need mm-hmm. the 7 cents per hour that could
seven.
Spin.
First of all, you're getting 7 cents. Holy cow!
Is it down to five?
It's a penny.
Is it down to three? Oh, it's a penny. Penny now.
So it's between penny and 12 cents. So if you're good, you get up to 12 cents. But generally, everyone's at a penny.
Oh geez. Well, I've got a film at least at seven. So let me give you.
Wow! Hope. Wait a minute. You've got a 7 cents an hour movie. It's quality.
I didn't know that was such a big deal. Now I'm more excited about the 7 cents.
Oh, you kidding me? Seven cents.
Check out my films then online. I mean, geez, apparently I'm making Muco bucks.
Oh, no. You're a 7 cents an hour filmmaker, my friend. That is something to put on. That's like an Oscar. Like you're up there.
I don't know about Oscar. I don't know about all of my films, but I've seen one. That was a couple years ago. I don't know. Now I feel it. You know what's funny is we're having this conversation. It's like, oh, 7 cents an hour. Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Do you see what we're – this is a ridiculous business. We're in an absolutely ridiculous business. But we can't do anything else. We're stuck here. It's
storytelling. Telling stories. And, you know, it all bites us and we all got a story to tell. And
yeah, man,
you know, Best Formats Film.
Luke, it has been an absolute pleasure, man, talking to you. This has been a just knowledge bomb filled episode, which I knew it would be. I think it's, I'm going to make sure this is mandatory listening for all filmmakers, because I covered things in this, and you and I covered things in this episode that I've never really had on the show before. So, it's really, really great stuff. So
why I wanted to share with everybody, and I want to at least leave with this last, like, I am a filmmaker out of South Dakota. I went to Los Angeles for a few years, and now I'm back doing the films where I live. So let that be an encouragement to all of those people sitting and saying, like, how can I do this? Totally doable. You can do it from even little state of South Dakota. So just keep hanging in there.
Luke, thanks again, my friend. I appreciate it. Stay safe out there.
Awesome. You too. Stay safe. We'll talk soon. Hopefully real soon.
I want to thank Steven for being on the show and dropping those knowledge bombs and inspiration bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Steven. If you want to get links to anything we discussed in this episode, please head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/408. And if you want to sign up for my new course, The Complete Film Distribution Blueprint, the course is now currently closed, but we'll be reopening sometime in the next couple months. If you want to get early access, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/letmein. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.